I would like to now reconvene the Conservation Committee portion of the meeting, and as we change the order of the agenda slightly, I would now like to go back to the printed agenda, and the first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
Move.
Second.
Approved by Brown, second by Hickson. Let's see, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, land and water plan update. Mr. Smith.
Okay, thanks, Chairman. Just a couple of things. One, I want to remind everybody that Texas is hosting the Southeastern Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies annual meeting in Corpus Christi, October 12th through the 15th. That is a great and golden opportunity for us to showcase all of the wonderful fish and wildlife law enforcement work that we have going on throughout the state. Again, the 12th through the 15th, we expect probably 800 professionals or so from around the Southeast to come to Texas, and certainly hope that some or all of you can be there for that meeting. So more to come there. Other two things I want to talk about are ones that we've talked quite a bit about. Yes?
October what?
12th through the 15th in Corpus Christi. Theme is Our Land, Our Water, partnerships, new partnerships in wildlife management. The next thing or two things I want to talk about have to do with all of the really good work that our inland fisheries team has been doing on hydrilla control. That's been a big issue for us there at Lake Conroe. I think many of you have heard quite a bit from constituent groups over the years. Our team put together a two-year plan to control hydrilla, working in concert with the San Jacinto River Authority. I've had some really good success recently in terms of reducing hydrilla coverage from a little over 2,000 surface acres down to just a couple of hundred acres in the lake. So really proud of that team and all of the work that everybody that's been working on it has seen come to fruition. Along those lines, we have also recently received a grant from the Fish and Wildlife Service for about $425,000 to help us with additional aquatic invasive species control in lakes in East Texas. Again, big challenge that you're going to hear more about in a presentation coming up. But just want everybody to know the work that's going on with our fisheries team, our law enforcement team, communication. Everybody's really been focusing on that, on those aquatic bodies. So that's it for me. Thanks, Chairman.
Thank you. The committee item number two, feral animal control, Mr. Scott Borff.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Scott Borff, Deputy Executive Director of Operations. I'm here today to figure out how to operate the machine. There it is. Here today to give you a briefing on the agency's policies and activities related to the management of exotic and feral animals. Most of you are probably aware, and particularly for those commissioners who are relatively new to the agency, that from time to time we get feedback from the community relative to some of our practices. And last November we had an incident out in West Texas on Big Bend Ranch State Park with some complaints coming in about our management of feral burrows out there. So this briefing was really prompted by that, but we thought it would be important to let you know what our issues are with not only burrows. I'll figure it out in a minute. But all feral and exotic animals. Obviously, exotic species are those that have been introduced into our properties. And by the way, this is a briefing on how we manage on our properties, not on private property in Texas. And then feral animals are those individual animals that have been domesticated at one point but have been released and have reverted to the wild state. The most common problems we have around the state in terms of looking at the broad spectrum of properties that we have are with feral hogs, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I think it's important to know that feral hogs are pretty common around the state now. We do have hog problems in virtually every state park and wildlife management area that we work in. Further east and south you go, the more problem you have. There's not quite as much problem out in West Texas, but they're beginning to show up in West Texas too. We have feral goats scattered around the state that we have to try to manage, and we have Audad sheep, which are not feral but are an exotic species that have been introduced primarily out in West Texas, and then of course the burros, which have been the subject of some feedback we've received lately. I do want to do something I don't usually do here. I want to read real briefly the three goals in our strategic plan, and I'm talking about the operational strategic plan, the land and water conservation and recreation plan, that direct us to manage these feral and exotic species. Goal number two is, it reads, to conserve, manage agency sites for recreational opportunities, biodiversity, and cultural heritage in Texas. Goal number five reads to enhance the quality of hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation, which includes restoring aquatic and terrestrial habitats where feasible to sustain and enhance healthy ecosystems. And goal number seven, which is to maintain and or improve quality and quantity of water to support the fish, wildlife, and recreation of Texas, of Texans. Those goals are all relative to the long-standing agency policy that has been established by the agency for a couple of decades now to try to manage these feral and exotic animals in our properties to reach those particular goals. The major impacts that these kind of feral animals have to the ecosystems that I just described is that many times they outcompete native species for limited resources, and that certainly has been the case if you want to discuss the burros in particular in West Texas. I'm going to take the time at the end of the presentation to share with you a brief 5-minute video that was produced by the Navy on some of their desert properties to demonstrate visually how impactful burros can be. They very often contaminate riparian areas, and particularly water sources that are very rare and unique in desert environments. They often damage cultural resources because historically those cultural resources are found in close proximity to water for obvious reasons. They promote soil erosion by overgrazing plant communities, particularly near the water sources, and they do spread diseases. I will let you know that we do not have line item funding for feral or exotic animals. These are activities that are opportunistic on each one of our areas. So whether you're talking about a wildlife management area or a state park or even fish hatcheries on occasion, because they do also have problems with hogs, we don't have a line item that says, here's you some money to go out and take care of these feral animals. We expect the staff to do that in a reasonable fashion, in a professional fashion, but it's something that's done opportunistically when the opportunity arises. We use tools all the way on one end of the spectrum, from live trapping to the other end of the spectrum, which is lethal removal. We do many times, for example, encourage public hunting opportunities, for example, with hogs. Most of our areas where you go out, and you heard earlier about some of the hunting that goes on in state parks, we also have that hunting in wildlife management areas. Many times when those folks go out there, we encourage them when the opportunity arises to take hogs. But the lethal removal has been something that we've taken some feedback from, and I'll share with you in a minute what the feedback revealed. One of the things I want to share with you is that since this came up in the state park, in Big Bend Ranch State Park, relative to the burros last November is when this kind of came up again, the division, the State Parks Division, has a very comprehensive set of policies and procedures relative to the way they remove these animals. And for example, you cannot just, the staff has to be certified in the use of a particular firearm before they can use that firearm to lethally remove exotic and feral animals on state parks. And so those folks have to have gone through a course where they're certified to be accurate and know how to use that weapon in order to minimize any potential for wounding and allowing that animal to suffer. So we're very conscientious about removing these animals in a humane fashion when we do so. These are just some examples. We got problems with audads at Paladuro, Devil's River, and Big Bend Ranch, which I've already described. Hogs are pretty much widespread across the agency's lands, but we have particular problems right now at Government Canyon and Somerville. Out at Colorado Bend, there's quite a big herd of feral goats. And then what prompted this briefing is the burro issue out at Big Bend Ranch State Park. when the issue flared up in November about the removal of burrows in Big Bend Ranch State Park, we thought it was a good idea at that point to temporarily suspend the lethal removal of those animals until we could have an opportunity to give the public some chance to give us feedback about alternative methods for removal. We also then went through a thorough review of State Park's procedures on the removal of these animals, and we made sure that we thought those were appropriate, which by and large they were. We may do a couple of minor tweaks. Probably most significantly, we partnered with an animal rescue, in fact, a burrow rescue group out of California that has some experience doing live trapping of burrows around the country. And we're not particularly optimistic that they would have significant impacts given the rugged terrain at Big Bend Ranch State Park. And in fact, we checked with them just this morning. They've been out there about 3 or 4 months making efforts to live trap burrows, and they have captured 0 burrows in 3 or 4 months. So we're going to continue with that program, and I don't want to suggest prematurely that it's unsuccessful. It's just a difficult activity in that rugged of a terrain to try to capture animals that have become wild and are free roaming out there. Obviously, we don't have a lot of fences out there, and so that adds to the problem. Those animals are free to move wherever they want to move, and they don't hang around when people are out there very much. We've also hosted 5 and soon to be 6 statewide meetings. Pardon me. Where we went out to San Antonio, Austin, Richardson, El Paso, and Presidio. We will be going to Houston, I believe, next week, just to give folks an opportunity to tell us what they think we might could be doing better or differently. I'll let you know some of the examples. In San Antonio, we had 2 people show up. One was slightly opposed, and one had nothing better to do, so they came to the meeting. In Austin, 5 folks showed up. We had 2 of those folks were in favor of us using lethal methods. 1 was against, and 2 were neutral. In Richardson, 4 people showed up. 2 were for, and 2 were neutral. In El Paso, 1 person showed up, and they were against us using lethal. Presidio was the highest turnout. We had 25 people show up in Presidio. 23 of those people were from Terlingua. There was an individual in Terlingua that kind of organized an effort to make sure that his and his peers, perspectives were heard by us, and so they did show up, 25 of them, and most of those were against use of lethal methods. We did get some recommendations ranging anywhere from birth control pills for the burros to trapping, which of course we're trying to do. So we took it seriously, and I don't mean to minimize the seriousness with which the agency approached this. I mean, we do serve lots of constituents out there. There are people that don't approve of us using lethal means to remove these feral animals, and we thought it was appropriate to listen to them and to try to come up with solutions that address their concerns, and that's what we will continue to try to do. Before I take questions, I would like to show you this brief video. It's kind of an old video. It was done 15 or 20 years ago by the Department of the Navy at China Lake in California, which is out in the Mojave Desert. It was actually a range that they use for target practice and those kind of things, but they have had and continue to have serious problems with the burros out there, and ultimately, because of some of the same kind of feedback they were getting back then, put together this film to demonstrate the kind of damage that a burro does in the desert. So I'd ask the folks to put that video up.
Critically important strains and seeds support life in this arid environment. Many animal species and some plant species are totally dependent on these water sources.
Feral burrows, that is, wild burrows, whose ancestors were once domesticated, are not native to these deserts. In fact, they're not even native to the United States. Burrows were introduced to North America by the Spaniards some 400 years ago. These burrows adapted well to the desert, surviving on sparse vegetation and little water. When food and water are plentiful, they thrive. Burrows have no known natural predators in the United States. They have a lifespan of about 25 years. With indiscriminate breeding, the burrow population doubles at least every 5 years.
By 1982, there were between 3,500 and 5,700 burrows on the Senator's ranges. The impact of the exploding burrow population is, quite simply, ruining the desert. Burrows feed intensely with native animals for food, water, and space. And the burrows usually win, forcing native species away from the natural habitat. This competition is greatest around water sources.
Natural springs and seeps, with fragile riparian vegetation, form oases for desert wildlife. These oases provide water and food for all wildlife, while small species also use these areas for shade, protective cover, and breeding and nesting sites.
Here again, springs. Every burrow use has drastically changed the delicate balance that exists between water, plants, and animals. Burrows have eaten or destroyed most of the vegetation. And they have significantly reduced the water output of the spring. As a result, they have forced many indigenous animals away from the area. What's left of the saltbush, a prime forage plant for many native animals, has been trampled and browsed so severely that it won't recover.
Continual feeding on one plant species in an area often results in permanent changes to the composition of the plant community. Plant diversity is reduced, desirable native plants disappear, and less palatable plants such as tansy mustard, cheatgrass, and tumbleweed take over. More importantly, however, burrows influence the quantity and quality of water sources. Low springs on the center are very small, producing as little as 1 gallon of water an hour. Some springs produce less than 1 gallon a day. Enough, however, to support a local native wildlife community that has adapted to a limited water supply. Each burrow, on the other hand, can consume at least 3 to 5 gallons of water daily. Trampling can reduce or even stop the water flow. They often contaminate the water with feces and urine.
We estimate that burrow overuse of hidden springs has reduced the water output by 50 to 75%. And they have severely contaminated what little water remains. We believe that many animals leave the area because they refuse to drink contaminated water.
Burrow, by overgrazing what forage there is, and by creating extensive trail networks as they travel between water sources, are killing plants and compacting the soil. As a result, the soil fertility, the same vegetation, is severely curtailed. Rainfall does not readily penetrate the compacted soil, and vegetation cannot exist without water. Erosion increases, and the aridity of the desert is intensified. Recovery of damaged areas may take decades, hundreds of years, if they recover at all. Here at China Lake, we have found that burrows damage water resources, vegetation, and soil. They compete with native animals for food, water, and shelter, forcing many species away from their natural habitat and ultimately threatening their very existence.
Thank you.
In conclusion, Commissioners, I'd like to say two things just so you are fully informed here. The original complaint back in November was that there was a cruelty to animal complaint, that we were shooting animals and allowing them to wander off and die in bad circumstances. And the second part of the complaint was that staff from Austin were going out there and hunting these animals. We had that. We took this complaint seriously. We take those kind of complaints seriously. That's one of the reasons we immediately put the stop to this activity until we could do a further investigation. We referred that immediately. In fact, the very day that I got the call, I consulted with Mr. McCarty, and we made the recommendation to Internal Affairs. We stopped all those lethal removal activities out there, and Internal Affairs conducted a very thorough investigation, sent a couple of investigators out, I think, the very next day, spent a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, investigating thoroughly and found no substantiation to the complaint about animal cruelty or to the complaint that, that they were being hunted for sport by the Austin staff. The circumstances that led to that particular set of complaints had more to do, I think, with the fact that we were undergoing a very rigorous review of the new public use plan in Big Bend Ranch State Park. We did have some senior Austin staff out there at that time trying to help get that plan implemented, working with the local politicians as well as the State Parks, Big Bend Ranch Advisory Board that was out there at that time. And so, you know, the opportunity presented itself, and there were some animals shot. There was no evidence those animals were treated inhumanely. There was no evidence that there was any effort to go hunting. It so happened people were out there from Austin at the same time, and yes, some people from Austin did participate in removing with lethal means some of those burros. Bottom line, it was thoroughly investigated. You may continue to get some complaints from folks. We'd be glad to share any of that information that you would like, but it was, and I will remind you that Internal Affairs does not report to me, so this was not something that I had any control over, but we did take it seriously about moving that into the Internal Affairs and making sure that we didn't find any evidence of any cruelty to animals or inappropriate hunting by any of our staff. Yes, sir.
What size bird do we estimate that we have on the park? And then, you know, what is our ultimate goal? Is it to remove all burros from the park?
Mr. Brown, we don't have a good number. Our best guesstimate at this point is about 400 animals. I will tell you that I just got information today that the Department of Public Safety is going to be going out to the ranch to look at, in the wake of our implementation of the new public use plan, they're going to be out there to look at some sites where they might could land a helicopter in case somebody gets hurt in a backcountry spot or something like that. We've asked them to do a survey while those helicopters are out there at no additional expense to us or them, with our staff with them, to try to do a survey to get a better handle on the total number of animals out there. But it's probably several hundred, from 300 to 500 is what we're guessing. But these are very wild animals in very remote locations, and so for us to get a hard number has been pretty difficult. We don't hold out any hope that we would ever eradicate such a population of wild animals in such rugged terrain. We don't use words, at least we try not to use words like eradicate, because we don't think that's realistic. We do think it's important, not just at Big Bend Ranch, but at all our facilities, to try to manage those animals the best we can. We do, for example, have a strong intention to expand our bighorn sheep restoration program to the Big Bend Ranch State Park. It's probably the next major site that we have. Burros in and of themselves don't present a threat to bighorn sheep, but as you saw on the slide and as you heard, they do compete and many times outcompete native species, including bighorn sheep, for limited resources, particularly water. And so while I think it would be an overstatement to say you have to get rid of the burros in order to reinstate the bighorn sheep, it's an important component. The audads are just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, to the bighorn sheep restoration program. And I'd say the same thing there. We will have to manage down the numbers of audads as well as the number of burros in that park before I think our bighorn sheep experts would be comfortable letting it become the next release site.
Any other comments from... Thank you very much, Scott, for clarifying that issue. And I will say that feral species, I think, are going to be something that we're dealing with on an increasing number of times in the future. And I'll also say that although the numbers in West Texas aren't anywhere near what they are in South Texas, they're definitely on the increase, and they are becoming quite a nuisance. So
An invasive species, as you know, I didn't speak to the plant issue here. You're going to hear right after me, I think, a presentation from our wildlife and fisheries divisions about the invasive species that are on the plant side of the picture here.
Sure. Thank you very much. Let's see, item number three, nuisance vegetation update. Dr. Earl Chilton and Ms. Kelly Bender.
Chairman, other members of the commission, my name is Earl Chilton. For the record, this is Kelly Bender. What we'd like to do today is give you a brief update on invasive species issues and activities around the state, including some specific hotspots. The first hotspot I'd like to talk about is Lake Conroe. Mr. Smith's already mentioned that. As you can see from this slide, this is what the hydrilla looked like on Lake Conroe just a few years ago. About 20 years ago, or a little over in the early 80s, hydrilla covered almost half of Lake Conroe, and it was a very serious issue. The stocking of 270,000 grass carp basically eliminated that problem at that time, and Lake Conroe remained hydrilla-free for the next 13 to 14 years, but it started to come back in the mid-90s. And we kept it under control, as I said at the last briefing, for the first 9 years or so with herbicides. But due to the fact that hydrilla has actually been measured to grow up to 4 inches a day, herbicides alone weren't able to take care of the problem after a while. And we determined it was time to try to use grass carp again. Well, before, the use of grass carp had been such a divisive issue that we knew we couldn't just develop a plan and put grass carp in there. What we wanted to do is meet with the constituents first. We met with angling groups that had opposed the use of grass carp before and explained to them why we wanted to use them. We met with the property owners and explained the kind of methodology we wanted to use, because in the past this issue had actually led to legal action as well as legislative action before it was resolved. As a result, we founded the Lake Conroe Advisory Board, and we meet with them on a regular basis. We developed a two-year management plan, as Mr. Carter said, which began in 2006. This plan was based upon the methodology we used in Lake Austin, which was an incremental stockings of triploid or sterile grass carp, in conjunction with vegetation surveys over a two-year period. As you can see on this slide, over the first 2 years, we got a steady increase in hydrilla, despite the fact that we were incrementally stocking grass carp. That is actually what we expected. That's what we saw in Lake Austin, and we felt that the hydrilla was going to drop out after about 2 years, and in fact it did, within 2 weeks of what we predicted. It fell out. We went from over 2,000 acres to over 300 acres in a period of about a month and a half. Currently, we probably have less than 300 acres in the lake. We are going to conduct another survey later this month, and obviously continue our efforts with the property owners, the angling groups, to keep the situation under control. We've pledged $25,000 for habitat restoration should all of the vegetation be eliminated from the lake, because we want to maintain good fishing habitat. Lake Conroe has become quite a fishery in that part of the state. So you can see, the areas that were primarily infested with hydrilla included these three coves. And unfortunately, the two coves I'm telling you about there are also the coves that have the highest property values and are the most developed. So that's really the issue on Lake Conroe. Toledo Bend in 1998 was infested with a floating fern called Salvinia molesta. Now, Salvinia molesta has the ability to double in population size basically about once a week. And we found it in 1998, and we kept it under control with herbicides and with favorable lake fluctuations. Mother Nature helped us. But in 2000, between 2003 and 2004, the giant salvinia population exploded from 150 acres to over 3,000 acres in 1 year. Within the next year, it expanded another 2,000 acres, and favorable lake fluctuations and as well as herbicide treatments have kept it from exploding anymore, but we still have excessive populations of giant salvinia on the lake that affect boater access, skiing, swimming, and so forth. So we're going to keep that under control. We put a giant salvinia weevil in the lake as well. It's a biocontrol that's proven to be effective basically everywhere it's been used around the world. But where it's been used is usually in tropical areas, and we're just a little bit above that, so we're still waiting to see exactly how effective that is going to be. The Rio Grande is infested with quite a few invasive species. The one in your upper left-hand corner is a water hyacinth. If you be in the late 90s and early 2000s, water hyacinth infested about 100 miles of the Rio Grande. That's actually the main channel of the Rio Grande back then. And that same 100 miles was also infested with water lettuce. You see that in the lower left, and with hydrilla. We've seen images of that from Lake Conroe. We were able to maintain control of these species in 2003, gain control with the use of herbicides, with Mother Nature again, who gave us rain, and with mechanical harvesters, as well as triploid grass carp. Those issues seem to be under control for the time being. But right now, the problem that's causing us the most pain on the Rio Grande is giant reed. It's the plant in the upper right-hand corner of your screen. It's exploded from about 10,000 acres a few years ago to close to 100,000 acres now. Estimates are that it probably uses about three times as much water as native vegetation. The USDA is working on a number of biological controls for that, but those have to be approved by both Canada and Mexico. They submit what's called a document to a technical advisory group composed of the United States, Mexico, and Canada. I actually wrote the section on alternative methods of control for this plant, and we're hoping to get at least one of the bugs registered and approved this year. Typically, we use either biological controls, mechanical harvesters, or herbicides to control invasive weeds in the aquatic environment. However, because mechanical harvesters and shredders are generally not as cost-effective as the other two methods, it usually comes down to either herbicides or biological controls. And therein lies the problem. There's usually a conflict between the people that want to use herbicides versus those that want to use biological controls. Basically, herbicides tend to work quicker. The argument for herbicides, they work quicker, they're more reliable. That's the argument. You don't have to introduce any new organisms into the environment that could potentially get out of control. They're easy to use because most people understand how to use herbicides from around their homes, and you can put them exactly where you want them. On the biological control side, once you introduce the organisms, they're in there, for a few years. And if they're reproducing organisms, they can stay there. So they're ultimately, it may be cheaper, although the results are less certain. Because in some cases, biological controls may take years to work, and they still won't get rid of the plant. In some cases, they do, though. So it's it depends on the plant. It depends on the biological control. The other plus for biological controls is that no chemicals are introduced into the environment. But people do complain that their use is complicated because typically it's associated with some research and some monitoring to make sure that they're not eating anything else and they haven't gotten out of control. Well, in order to help us manage invasive species in both the aquatic environment and in the terrestrial environment, we formed a Texas Invasive Species Coordinating Committee. It's to facilitate information exchange among state agencies and really to try to help us get federal funding as well. the agencies that are involved are TPWD, the Texas State Soil and Water Conservation Board, the Texas Department of Agriculture, TCEQ, the Texas Forest Service, the Texas Department of Transportation, Texas AgriLife, which used to be the Extension Service, and the Texas Water Development Board. Additionally, we have formed a new organization called the Texas IPSI, or Invasive Plant Council. It's more of a non-profit organization. Our department is also involved in three regional panels of the National Invasive Species Task Force. We're heavily involved in the Gulf and South Atlantic States Regional Panel, the Western Regional Panel, and the Mississippi River Basin Regional Panel. I'll let Kelly update you now on the terrestrial side.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Kelly Bender. I'm a Texas Parks and Wildlife Urban Wildlife Biologist. Good to be here. Now, you've heard about the burrows, you've heard about the aquatic plants, and now you're going to hear about the terrestrial plants. I'm sure you understand by now that invasive exotic plant infestation or organism infestation is one of the most serious ecological threats or threats to ecosystem health, as well as opportunities for outdoor recreation present today. So this presentation, this presentation is going to be examining three examples of some of the exotic species, some of the worst that we have here in Texas, as examples of what potential ecological harm they can cause, as well as prevention of outdoor recreation. We're also going to review quickly the legislative authority granted to agencies in Texas, who's responsible for these species and how do we deal with them, and look at our proactive actions, Texas Parks and Wildlife's actions in dealing with the invasive species problem, particularly terrestrial plants. So let's start with those three worst of the worst species, salt cedar or tamarisk species. There are several of them. They were introduced in the 1800s as an ornamental shade tree. They're also used as erosion control and were used quite successfully for a number of years until we realized in about the 1920s that they pose a significant threat to ecosystem health. What they do is they put down an extraordinarily long taproot, about 150 feet long. They're able to submerge their roots into the underground water supply, unlike other species, and actually lower the water table. And in this way, they're able to outcompete other native species, like the willows and the cottonwoods, in riparian areas. And so they eliminate their competition and then come in and infest an area. To put this in perspective, a heavily infested area can actually use as much as twice the annual consumption of water for a moderately sized city. The numbers to that are 200 gallons a day evapotranspirated from the ground into the air. To put that into further perspective, a human being typically uses that amount of water in a month. So they're thirstier than we are. It is statewide listed as a noxious species through Texas Department of Agriculture. It is controlled, and it is controlled in both biological methods as well as mechanical and herbicide methods. One of the most promising is the salt cedar leaf beetle. These are native to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, which is where the salt cedar is native. The only known host plant for the salt cedar leaf beetle is the tamarisk set of species. This is the one that just kills, that means the most to me. This is Chinese tallow. It was introduced in 1772 by Ben Franklin, bless his heart, as an ornamental species. It has beautiful fall foliage and is well utilized by birds. And it is utilized in repair. It is highly adaptable, so it does very well in just about any landscape. Unfortunately, that's where the problem is. While it tends to like riparian areas best, it does well in just about any area and outcompetes, creating a monoculture, and that is a single species stand of Chinese tallow. Why is this a problem? In the Gulf states, and let's look at Galveston County in particular, since 1970, the area of monoculture in that one county has gone from 5 acres in 1970 to today over 30,000 acres in that one county. It's pretty widespread. Why is it something that we worry about? Of course, we never, as wildlife managers, want to see a monosystem, a monoculture of any one species. It inhibits diversity. But in this particular case, also, it changes the soil chemistry. As the leaves fall from the tree and begin to decay in the soil, it changes the soil chemistry such that other plants can't germinate. So it not only does it is an aggressive spreader, but it also inhibits other species. Not only other plant species, but as I was doing some research looking at how bad this guy really is, I found that it actually inhibits the, or it increases mortality of tadpoles. So you're not going to hear a whole lot of frogs in a Chinese tallow stand. This is especially disconcerting because Chinese tallow tends to form monocultures in wet areas, which is also where the frogs like to be. How do you control it if you're interested? It's hard. It keeps coming back. You can't plow because it resprouts. But if you do burn it a couple of times, you will get a pretty good handle of it. Also, basal spraying of triclopyr or glyphosate, thank you, is about 90 to 99% effective if used repeatedly. All right. The old world blue stems were introduced in the 1930s as an improved grass for improved pasture land. Improved, if I still did air quotes, I'd improve pasture land, because it has a tendency to aggressively spread. It's a warm season annual, warm season perennial, and instead of forming a bunch grass system, which is what's native here, those little blue stems and Sidotes grama and Indian grass that's native here. It forms a turf, which is a very densely vegetated area that doesn't allow grassland nesting birds or other wildlife to move through it and among it. So it drastically changes the ecosystem. A lot of people see it and they think, you know, one grass is as good as another for a dickcissel or a quail or a Houston toad, but it turns out that it is a very significant change into the environment. Such that if you look at if you compare an old CRP with native species in it and an old world blue stem pasture, you'd see significantly fewer not only grassland nesting birds but also arthropods, which are the crickets and the grasshoppers that they're feeding on. So not only does it not provide them a place to nest, it also doesn't provide them food on the table. Okay, so it's gotten about as bad as it can get, right? So who's responsible? Just to review, there's a shared legislative authority between Texas Parks and Wildlife and Texas Department of Agriculture. Texas Parks and Wildlife prohibits or regulates fish, shellfish, and aquatic plants, as Earl has been speaking about earlier. Texas Department of Agriculture has legislative authority over the sale and transport of noxious weeds and invasive species and prohibits those. However, there's a list of 13... Do you remember 14?
Not invasive prohibited plants.
I'm sorry, yeah. Okay, somewhere around 13 or 14 invasive species, whereas we actually know that there are known 25,000 species across the U.S. that have escaped cultivation. So they are dealing with the worst of the worst. There are a lot more out there. So what is Parks and Wildlife doing about it? In 2005, staff from Coastal Fisheries, Inland Fisheries, and Wildlife came together to form an ad hoc working group or committee to define, well, what exactly is it that we're dealing with? What species do we have in Texas that we should be looking at? So we defined about 400 different species that were known to have escaped cultivation here in Texas. And then we categorized them by whether they were known to be noxious, whether they were known not to be invasive, or whether they were simply, we didn't know enough about them to categorize them one way or the other. In doing so, we hope to inform future Texas Parks and Wildlife activities as well as our partner agencies' activities in planning eradication or control efforts in the future. As Earl mentioned earlier, we've also become involved, and Earl's been instrumental in developing the Texas Invasive Species Coordinating Committee, developed with 8 state agencies through an MOA, and continues to be a great source of information and information exchange, as well as an opportunity to explore funding opportunities federally. finally, we've just recently provided additional funding for a citizen science effort called the Texas Invaders. It's through the Pulling Together Initiative, and you can find more about it at texasinvasives.org. And it is a citizen science program where we empower and provide training and recruitment and materials for citizens throughout the state of Texas to collect data on invasive species that they know of in their own area. And this way we can collect much more data than would ordinarily have been possible with our own staff. Also, they download their data onto or upload their data onto an online resource where we're able to validate it, use the data for analysis, and also map the data as well. This was funded through a generous grant through the Wildlife Diversity Conservation Grant, which is the horned lizard money that was recently released. So that's it. The invasive species continue to be a particular problem in Texas and throughout the United States. We hope to be able to utilize these actions to continue to plan, eradicate, and control invasive species for the benefit of terrestrial ecosystems as well as aquatic ecosystems. Thank you very much.
Kelly, is there any means to disseminate this information that you're gathering, other than the website that you, or the link that you included, but for private landowners to be able to benefit from the progress in our control of these species? I mean, these, especially on the aquatic side, a lot of the impounded lakes on private lands are suffering from the same infestations. And so, you know, to be able to share this information with the private sector, I think, is important.
Absolutely. Do you want to address that with the ISTE? Okay.
We have developed a number of brochures, including brochures that explain how to identify some species. There's quite a bit of literature out there. The problem is just disseminating it. And
are these chemicals ones that, if you did want to apply them privately, I mean, would you need a license to?
There's only one that you need to have a license for. It's right. You're talking about an aquatic environment. 2,4-D is the only one you really need to have a license for, and you can get 2,4-D that's diluted at Walmart, but it's not the same.
Sure.
So, but if you want to do it in an aquatic system, you have to be a certified pesticide applicator. Glyphosate, the other ones you don't have to.
Thank you. Any other
chairman?
Yes. Dr. Chilton, for instance, on Toledo, what sort of cooperation can we get out of the state of Louisiana? Are they helping the giants?
They are trying. Their state agency, Louisiana Fish and Game, has been allocated extra money for giant salvinia, but they have infestations that are much worse elsewhere in the state. Most of that money is going somewhere else. The Louisiana side of the Sabine River Authority is putting up money. They're doing spraying on their side of the river. At least that's what the Texas people are telling me. So the Texas Sabine River Authority and the Louisiana Sabine River Authority are working together. The Texas side actually gives us about $100,000 a year for work on Toledo Bend. We are actually also working with Louisiana on Cattle Lake as well, the salvinia infestation there.
Yeah, I didn't understand whether or not the information that you say is in brochures to help folks identify the various species. Is that available on the Parks and Wildlife website as well?
Most of that information is, yes. They can download it. It's PDF files. They can download it and print it out if they want.
Is there also information on how you can treat it, what you can use to address it, or where you might go for it?
Yes, one of the brochures I wrote myself, it's got information about how to treat
it. Is that information on the website?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I should say also there are publications through the Wildlife Diversity Program on terrestrial invasive species as well. And we focus on providing alternatives, especially for folks in urban areas when they're choosing their landscaping. Because many of these, about 85% of these terrestrial species, were actually imported as ornamental species. We're trying to discourage it at the source.
Aside from the, because you should mention, aside from the brochures there, we have a guidance document that's also on our website. And there's information, biological information, about a number of the aquatic species and not only the herbicides, but the pros and the cons of using the different herbicides. So there's quite a bit of information on our website about that.
Any other comments? Discussion? If not, thank you both for your presentation.
Thank you.
Committee item number 4 has been addressed in executive session. Committee item number 5, land donation, Williamson County, 6.18 acres at Twin Lakes County Park. Mr. Corky Coleman.
For the record, Corky Coleman with the Land Conservation Program. This item is one we saw last session. It's in Williamson County, Twin Lakes County Park. This park is right south of Cedar Park, between Cedar Park and Jollyville. It involves 50 acres that was given to us by legislative mandate during the 70th legislature to be deeded or leased to Williamson County as a county park. Now TxDOT has 6.18 acres more that they wish to become part of that park, but want to deed it to us. You just transfer them to be leased to Williamson County as part of the same park. As you can see in the hatch line, it is in holding within the 50 acres that is already leased from Parks and Wildlife to Williamson County. This is the request that you put it on tomorrow's agenda for a public comment and action. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Corky. Committee item number 6, land acquisition, Walker County, approximately 4 acres at Huntsville State Park.
Again, for the record, Corky Coleman. This is an item in Huntsville State Park, Parker County, Texas. This park south of Huntsville on I-45 between Huntsville and Conroe. This item is in regards to an acquisition of 4 to 5 acres of land. The land that we're talking about is a strip of land running from the state park to a sewer lift station in a near subdivision. It's a 40-foot strip that we need to purchase to hook Huntsville State Park up to municipal services. It's, it runs through a piece of property managed by Timbervist Management Property, a company, a corporation out of Atlanta, Georgia. We had gone to the national or the state, well, if you see north or northeast of that line, of the acquisition line, it's Sam Houston National Forest. We'd visited with those folks about getting an easement there. They have specifically written in their management plan prohibiting any wastewater lines running through National Forest. We had tried to buy an easement. The timber management company was more willing to sell us the land than to sell us an easement. You can see the relationship of the line, the proposed acquisition to the entire park. We'll buy a 40-foot strip, approximately 4,500 feet long. It'll be between 4 and 5 acres of land. This will enable us to hook to Huntsville municipal water and wastewater. I did get one email this morning from a citizen in Huntsville stating, and I might want to back up a second, stating that he approved of us hooking and the city, working with the city to hook up to municipal water and wastewater service. And his recommendation was is that we use this corridor also as a trail system through the state park, through the subdivision, back to the national park, which is feasible, and we've already spoken with Huntsville city officials about using this utility corridor as a trail system also. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from hearing none, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Corky.
Committee item number 7, pipeline easement, Orange County, Tony Houseman, Wildlife Management Area. Ted.
Chairman, Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item pertains to the granting of an easement for the installation of a 24-inch carbon dioxide pipeline across the Tony Houseman Wildlife Management Area, also known as Blue Elbow Swamp. It's on I-10, just north of the city of Orange, as you can see in this map. You can see in this map that it does cross swamp. You can see there are closed canopy forest areas as well as some wetland areas. There is an existing pipeline right away at this location. The new pipeline would require widening that existing easement by approximately 15 feet. Staff is currently negotiating terms and conditions both for initial impact assessment and for the long-term easement compensation to Parks and Wildlife for that. We would ask GLO to actually issue the easement because it is such a large pipeline, and they have a very good system in place for recording those, tracking those, and notifying us when they cycle and are due for renewal. Approximately 325 rods in length. Currently, our standard rate for such a pipeline is $30 per rod per year. That would be in addition to the initial impact assessment. The impacts would be temporary. Most of that pipeline right-of-way easement is allowed to revegetate naturally. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Staff recommends that this item be read tomorrow as an action item to proceed with issuance of the lease of the easement.
And what's the basis of the $30 per rod fee?
It's about half again what the market will bear. It's just we have looked at the fees charged by the General Land Office for their lands, the University of Texas charged on their lands, charged on private lands, and we have approximately doubled that. And what we have found through negotiating pipelines and easements across a number of wildlife management areas and state parks is that we believe that is about as much as we can possibly I don't mean to be crass, but that's about as much as we can possibly squeeze out of these easement negotiations.
A total of
$9,750 per year. I would also say that we also reserve the option in these easements to negotiate compensation in terms of goods and services. In this particular case, we are looking at some adjacent conservation lands. You saw in the map that there are adjacent undeveloped lands. In this case, the pipeline company is being quite cooperative and may actually use that projected revenue to purchase additional land for addition to the wildlife management area. We explore options other than cash in these cases.
And does the pipeline have the right to abandon the pipeline?
There are provisions in the easement language. That language has not been written. Usually we reserve the right to require that if the pipeline is abandoned, it be removed. We don't normally do that because that's normally more destructive of habitat than leaving it in place, but we normally reserve that option in case we have concerns about contamination or corrosion or other issues, erosion associated with the pipeline and so forth. We normally reserve that right.
Is that planned for this particular right-of-way agreement?
We are not to that point. The language has not been drafted. I think we may have someone in wildlife from that region that could address that, though. No, sir, I guess we don't.
I mean, is there any reason not to have, at least have the option to require?
We normally reserve that option, yes, sir.
Any other comments? Hearing none, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Regarding committee item number 4, right-of-way San Sabin, Lampasas County, Colorado Bend State Park, This item was dealt with in executive session, and I will authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. Committee item number 8, land acquisition, Brewster County, 20 acres at Big Bend Ranch State Park. Again, Ted.
Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is a recommendation from staff to acquire by purchase a 20-acre inholding inside a Big Bend Ranch State Park. It is a tract that is in a section accessible by road. Staff finds that failure to acquire this tract could result in development of the tract in the future. Staff has negotiated a contract at fair market value and from a willing seller, and the recommendation is that I be placed on tomorrow's agenda for consideration as an action item. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions or discussion? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. I invite you, Ted, to relax with us at the table while I take care of these others. Agenda item number 9, land exchange, Harris County, LaPorte Regional Office. I will authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. Agenda item number 10, land exchange, Aransas County, the Big Tree at Goose Island State Park. I will authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. Agenda item number 11, grant of easement, Aransas County, Goose Island State Park. I will authorize staff to begin public notice and input process. Agenda item number 12, land exchange, Bandera and Medina County, Hill Country State Natural Area. I will authorize staff to begin public notice and input process. Agenda item number 13, Coladura Property Acquisition in Randall County. I will authorize staff to begin public notice and input process. Agenda item number 14, land acquisition in Brewster County, 610 acres at Big Bend Ranch State Park. Once again, Ted.
Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This particular item also pertains to acquisition of an in-holding in Big Bend Ranch State Park. The tract is privately owned but is completely surrounded by property owned by Texas Parks and Wildlife and managed as Big Bend Ranch State Park. This particular tract has a county road running through it. Is particularly susceptible to development for uses not compatible with the public use of the park. It has been listed by a local broker. Staff has negotiated a contract of sale with the owner, and staff recommends that the commission authorize that the item be placed on tomorrow's agenda for consideration and action. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mr. Chairman, this committee, I believe, has completed its business.
Thank you, Commissioner Bibbs.
Thank you.
We'll move on to the Ad Hoc Infrastructure Committee. Commissioner Parker. You're supposed to pass you the gavel, but it looks pretty heavy there unless somebody wants to.
I'll give you one from this end.
That good? We need a portable one.
First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second. Commissioner Hickson and Commissioner Paul. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Committee item number 1, land and water update plan.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two quick things. One, phase 2 of the Sheldon Lake Environmental Learning Center is underway. We have started construction. We're going to proceed with the planning, actually, to start construction on the new lake observation tower there on site. And then we are working with TxDOT to finalize their improvements on the entrance road there, something that we believe will significantly help facilitate better access there. So those are moving forward. The last thing I want to mention is that we have completed our schematic designs for the new Game Warden Training Center there in Hamilton County. We're very, very pleased about that. We're going to be finalizing the construction drawings this summer, look to break ground in the fall, because we're going to have our first cadet class starting there in November, and so they're going to go through a lot of construction as they go through the academy simultaneously. So we are working in concert with the Texas Game Warden Association and the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation to help raise the requisite funds to help pay for that project in the aggregate. Right now we have funding to essentially complete the first phase of the project, and we are in a campaign to raise an additional $9 million to help see that through to fruition. So all is moving ahead well on that front. So that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Committee, item number two, capital programs, capital project update. Mr. Steve Wister.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, I am Steve Wiston, and I am fortunate to be the Director of Infrastructure Division. I know the hour's getting late, day's getting close to end. I'm going to try to be brief and push through my presentation. But before I do, with your permission, I'd like to first introduce my new deputy director. I'd like to introduce Scott Stover, who came on board about a week ago. Scott Stover joins us from the city of San Antonio, where he worked for 14 years as the manager of the Parks and Recreation Department capital program. They did repair and construction, and we're happy to have Scott join us. He was one of over 50 applicants, really qualified applicants, and we're happy to have him with us. Commissioners, and I guess maybe more for the new commissioners with us this afternoon, I'd like to begin my committee report with a brief summary of our capital program, our capital construction program for the 08-09 biennium, just to give you some perspective of what our capital program and project workload is all about. We began this fiscal year with the responsibility of managing a little over $131 million of capital construction funds or capital construction dollars. This program was made up of 274 capital projects funded from approximately 8 different funding sources, in some cases funded from multiple funding sources. Those sources include, and I'm probably not going to spend a lot of time on each one of these categories for the sake of time, but we had available to us this year about $670,000 that was appropriated issued to us through the Texas Public Finance Authority. It was interest earnings that we accrued over the life of the 03 Prop General Obligation Prop 8 bonds. That was additional revenues that came into the department. Those monies have been now assigned to projects that are well underway. In our program this year, we had a little over $11 million in bonds that were carried over from FY06, the general obligation program of GO bonds from 06. And as Carter mentioned, or Mr. Smith mentioned this morning, we are going to be managing over the course of this biennium an additional $69 million of new bonds for the 08-09 biennium for state parks repairs and for the Battleship Texas. We have $15 million in revenue bonds allocated to us in the last legislative session for the development of the East Texas fish hatchery. Additionally, about $23 million in Fund 9 MUT dollars that were allocated for the repair and construction of facilities in wildlife and inland and coastal fisheries and law enforcement facilities across the state. And finally, about $13 million of both federal and other donated funds. So it was a big program, and a program of that size obviously brings challenges to us and opportunities, and it's always a balancing act to try to address priorities for our customer divisions and set priorities and try to find ways to effectively manage 274 projects over the course of the time we have. So a big program, and wanted to give you a little perspective of what those challenges and opportunities were all about. Commissioners, I'm really pleased to report that we are on track with the expenditure of our prior issue of Proposition 8 general obligation bonds that was appropriated to us in FY06. If you recall, we got $18.1 million in bond proceeds that was allocated to 68 construction projects. The good news is that we expect all these projects to be under construction and the majority of all these funds fully encumbered by December 2008, prior to the start of the legislative session. We also expect that the majority of these projects will be complete and the dollars fully expended by the end of the biennium, by August 2009. And I feel like we're on track and on schedule to accomplishing and meeting that goal. As Mr. Smith mentioned to you this morning, we are exceedingly pleased, exceedingly happy, and somewhat relieved with the approval yesterday from the Legislative Budget Board and the release of funds for the 0809 program, the $44 million for state park repairs. This, in fact, gives us now the green light to go forward with the implementation of those projects. And we'll be obviously moving rapidly to get those underway. This total bond package, is reflected in this slide, includes $17 million of what remained from our old Proposition 8 authority and the appropriation of an additional $52 million of new Proposition 4 bonds that were approved by the voters last November. The Prop 4 bonds will provide another $27 million for state park repairs, $25 million, as Mr. Smith shared with you earlier, for the Battleship Texas. And I'm going to discuss the timeline for the issue of those funds in a few slides that follow. But again, we presently have, as a result of the authority given us yesterday, permission to go forward with the execution of that first $44 million. Commissioners, with your permission, I'd like to next just recap briefly our strategy for accelerating the delivery of these new projects, these new $0809 dollars that the legislature granted us for this biennium. After consulting over these last several months with a number of prominent design firms and large construction contractors across the state, we are in the process now of repackaging these 100 projects that make up this new funding into 22 larger projects, combining them into these two larger bundles of projects. The projects were bundled together either based on their geographic proximity to each other or by project type. And by that I mean we looked regionally across the state and if we found clusters of restroom repair projects within a region or wastewater projects within a region, we found it made good sense to bundle those into larger projects so that we could accelerate the delivery so we had one large project to manage instead of multiple projects that would take time and resources to implement. So we anticipate that this methodology is going to be effective, and I'll share with you in a moment here our timeline for doing so. In regard to the issue of bonds for the release of this money, well ahead of schedule, we got authority yesterday. Our next step is to, on June 5th, next week, we will appear before and present to the Texas Public Finance Authority our request for financing for this $44 million worth of funding. Following that, on July 17th, we appear before the Bond Review Board, in which we request their support and approval and the release and issue and sale of those bonds. Don't anticipate any problem or any obstacle in our way at this point, and feel like it's going to be pretty clear sailing here throughout the rest of the summer to make that happen. And then anticipate in August, early August, to receive the first issue of those bond dollars. This fiscal year, we've appropriated, have appropriation authority for $17 million of the Prop 8 funds and a little over $2 million of the Prop 4 funds. And then right around in September, following the next month, at the beginning of FY09, we'll have authority then to issue the remaining $25 million of the Prop 4 money for state park repairs. Our schedule for the actual implementation of these dollars for the design and construction follows on this slide. In advance, certainly, of receiving these dollars in September and August, we have already started the process of selecting our design firms. Our request for qualifications for the design firms that we're going to interview and determine goes out July 1st to hit the streets. We expect to negotiate the contracts and initiate the design services for these 22 bundled projects by November of this year, this fall. After we select our contractors, construction will start over a period beginning May 2009 through November 2009. All these 22 projects are not going to start at one time. They're going to be staggered over a few months period. This November 09 is a key date, commissioners. By November 09, all the projects will be under construction, and that's good news. With the exception of a little bit of funds that we'll hold back to administer and manage those projects, all the $44 million will be encumbered under a contract, and thus will significantly reduce our UB, or our unexpended balance. November 9 is 14 months after we receive the money, and about 26 months after the start of the biennium. So we're pleased with rolling out this strategy and anticipate we're going to be successful. Barring no complications, we hope to complete those 22 construction projects sometime between the period in spring of 2010 and fall of 2011. Commissioners, if you will, additionally, in looking at those bundles, we obviously identified projects that kind of just fell out. They just didn't fit within those bundles. An example might be a historic site restoration project that was kind of stuck in the middle of other water wastewater projects. It just didn't make sense strategically to bundle those together. So there's a few projects that kind of fell out of those bundles. $1 million of those projects have been allocated or assigned to our FORCE account, our in-house construction crew program. Those projects are going to start immediately at the beginning of the new fiscal year. So by September and October, we'll be kicking off about $1 million worth of construction projects that will be executed by our own in-house construction crews. And so we'll be well on our way to getting that started at the first of the fiscal year. Next, commissioners, if I may, I'd like to just to conclude with just a brief update of three of our more higher profile projects. Anticipating the release of the $25 million of Prop 4 bonds later this year for the dry berthing of the Battleship Texas, we're already working and working closely with not only State Parks Division, but with the Battleship Texas Foundation and planning for this dry berthing project. A pretty significant kind of a one-of-a-kind project because it's a one-of-a-kind resource and certainly a challenge to us because we've never tried to tackle the project of this type and scale before. So it comes with challenges, but we're really excited about the opportunity to do it. As you well know, our first step, the first question we had to answer for ourselves in looking at this project was to confirm whether or not this ship was able structurally to support itself out of water on concrete blocks, whether it was structurally capable and had the integrity any longer to support itself. Now, certainly a ship of this size was built to be dry berths for repairs, but only for short periods of time. And since we're talking about a permanent installation here, we felt it was incumbent and certainly crucial to determine that the ship was still in a structural condition that could support itself. In order to accomplish that, through the Battleship Texas Foundation, we assisted them in contracting with a Houston-based marine engineering firm called Procyanic, who did a condition assessment for us over these last several months. That condition report has been completed. It was submitted to us on May 15th. We're in the process of digesting that report now, but the news is good, and the recommendations and the results of their study is very positive. That report cost the Battleship Texas Foundation $93,000 to do, and they were good partners with us in trying to get that done. The survey results included, first and foremost, that the ship is in good shape. Structurally, it is. They confirmed structurally capable of supporting itself, and with some limited repairs, it is in good shape and can withstand the pressures and the stresses of resting permanently out of water, which is good news and what we suspected, but necessarily certainly to confirm. The other good news was that the ship was determined to be, to some extent, towable. They certainly recommended that the ship is not in any condition to take into open water. But a short tow within the Houston Ship Channel, they believed, would be permissible and not totally without risk, but would be something that they certainly would endorse and feel like was possible. So that provided us some opportunities then to look at options whereby we could take the ship out of the slip itself where it rests now, construct our dry berth, and have the opportunity to bring it back in when that development is completed. Contract went further in that we asked the consultant firm to take a look and give us recommendations on other options. What are the options? What are the different kind of dry berth options or alternatives do we have? And they came up with four recommendations, which I'd like to share with you, that are pretty unique. And I would like to introduce and ask Chris Greer to join me at the table. Chris is our project manager from Infrastructure Division, who, whether he liked it or not, inherited the Battleship Texas project. He's becoming quite a resident expert on the ship, and we're pleased to have him. He's the right person for this job. But Chris is certainly going to be more capable of answering any more specific questions you have about some of the methodologies that the consultant is recommending to us. These four options range in price for just the construction services, just for the raw construction cost, from around $22 million to about $27 million. So we feel like of the options that they are presenting to us, we can easily accomplish this project within the budget, within the $25 million that was appropriated to us by the legislature, in addition to the $4 million that is being provided to us by the Battleship Texas Foundation as their match. So we're looking at about a $29 million project budget and feel like these options are ones that we can accomplish for that amount of money. Here we go. These are conceptual renderings, and first let me share with you that the last time I was there, the Houston Ship Channel water didn't look quite this blue. And likewise, the background behind the ship wasn't quite this scenic, but for the sake of this rendering, I think it really illustrates the point, we hope. This first concept that they provided us was very similar to the graving dock or dry berth a solution that we had shared with you previously. It's very similar and almost identical to the solution that we were considering, in which they were creating a steel piling cofferdam that would surround the ship and create kind of a shoebox that would contain the ship. This particular solution obviously provides water access around three sides of the ship so that we could get a barge around or adjacent to the ship to be able, by crane, to make repairs on the ship in the future if that were necessary. But this sheet piling option was one that they supported. Chris, any observations or One of the sweeter advantages of this is that we open up the, that would be the starboard side of the ship with a long sloping view. You don't stand and look down into a box. You get to see the entire majesty of the ship and literally walk down and under it. Very panoramic. From the opposite side, the port side of the ship, it still appears as if it's floating in water. Very sentimental and important to a lot of patrons of the ship that it not appear odd. Well, in this case, we have both options there.
Okay. Second option that the consultants provided us was basically a concept that constructs a structurally supported earthen berm that, in effect, just closes off the slip built at the far end or at the stern of the ship from land point to land point. It just dams the water and allows us to evacuate the water and let the ship settle down on the concrete blocks surrounding the ship. Where the slip used to exist, we would create a stepped earthen kind of berm look, which we're very intrigued with aesthetically. We like the idea, we like the look of this, and kind of meets some of the similar goals that we felt like the first option did.
The advantage here is this is a static structure. There is no significant moving parts to maintain, no pumps and pipes and valves, except to flood the berth. This is a situation that occurs in a storm, for example. We would pre-flood the berth and not allow the ship to beat itself on its concrete pilings in anticipation of a hurricane or any other natural disaster. But this is literally an earthen dam with... for no better terms, no moving parts. Very simple. The previous example did have maintenance costs associated with maintaining a sheet pile solution. This one has is free from that.
Thirdly,
water out of that.
If it's a major influx of water, there's two stages of flooding. Water removal. That would be regular rainwater catchment that has to be done on a normal basis. And the second category is large-scale industrial pumps brought in for the instance. We considered putting that in and weighed against the number or frequency of times that we would actually flood the vessel. It made no sense to buy, maintain, and equip the dock with that. We can literally rent large-scale pumps. The action of moving the water back out is one that moves rather slowly. It's not a dramatic or hurried event in any case. So we'll rent the pipes of the pumps when we need to.
Okay. Third option we thought struck us is quite creative, something we had not anticipated and were a little taken back with at first, but the consultants were recommending resting the ship on a floating barge, a concept or an idea that really had never occurred to us. And certainly Chris can provide you the detail, but in essence, the construction or acquisition of some sort of submersible barge that could be floated under the ship and then lifted, and raise the ship out of water. So the ship would set and rest permanently on those concrete blocks, but on a floating barge.
Exactly. We need to find a deep hole in the Galveston Bay area. There are some dredged areas. You sink the barge. Pull the ship on top of it and pump the water out of the barge slowly, and it lifts up and eventually lifts completely out of the water. This rides about 6 feet above water, very little motion in it, and it's retained in place by a number of monopiles. You can disconnect this, take it somewhere, pull the barge just as if it's literally that, for movement to a separate location. All of these schemes have a measure of reversibility as part of our criteria. We don't want this ship in 100 years to be locked in one place and unmovable. So key criteria. This one is very mobile. You walk across a gangway onto the barge, and there are vertical transport elements, a stairwell and elevator to bring you up to the deck level, which is a good 60 feet above the surface of the barge. This is a very prominent view of the ship, more so than at sea level.
And lastly, a concept, the fourth option, that proposes, in effect, to shift and reposition the ship out of water and onto dry land.
Obviously, one advantage to this type of concept is that, unlike all the others, this location would cause the ship to be immune from any kind of storm damage, any kind of flood or storm surge, because of its elevation, because it's actually lifted out of the water and set at ground level. Of course, it also presents additional problems aesthetically with having 175-foot tall by 3-foot ball field long battleship, so more prominently in view at the site, but certainly a concept that we're going to take into consideration.
This is an engineering concept that would create a ring of which you see only the fourth remaining side. Build that and fill it full of water and literally float the ship to the north, that is where you see it here, and pump the water out. Subsequently, that earthen levee will be put in the existing slip, thereby restoring parts of the battleground that are currently configured as wet slip. Very clever idea, and the idea to keep the fourth side was part of the engineering effort, saying, well, that would allow us to get a ramp surface up to the 60-foot elevation where the ship would reside without mechanical means. Very dramatic impact visually to the site.
Moving then forward, Commissioners, our schedule for the issue of these bonds, the $25 million for the dry berth. As I mentioned, we did receive the condition assessment from the consultant on May 15th. It's our intent to take that information and submit our project plan, our proposal for the expenditure of these dollars that includes these four options and some broad range of costs, our strategy for going forward. We're going to submit that to the Legislative Budget Board on May 31st for their review and approval. We hope no later than July 25th to have received their approval and their authority to proceed, at which point, similar to the bonds for state parks repairs, on August 7th, the next scheduled meeting with the Texas Public Finance Authority Board meeting, and then we'll meet with the Bond Review Board on September 18th, anticipating the release of these dollars to allow us to start the project sometime in October, this coming fall. As far as the actual project delivery, Commissioners, it's our intent to begin this process similarly this summer. We're not waiting. We want to move forward with this, and we want to try to initiate the selection of our design consultant, the marine engineer and naval architects who will be responsible for taking this package, looking at these options, and helping us develop the solution and the strategy for going forward, and then developing the plans and specifications to accomplish this work. We are working on our request for qualifications. Those will be issued for design consultants this July. We expect to select the design firm to start the design immediately after we have the funds in hand, so sometime in October. And at the same time, we're anticipating at that point in time as well initiating the process of obtaining all what we believe to be the federal resource clearances that are going to be necessary to construct this project. Commissioners, because this ship is a national historic landmark and because it sits adjacent to a designated national historic site, and because the Battleship Texas Foundation is likely going to use federal dollars, federally appropriated dollars, as a part of their match, as a part of their contribution to this project. And finally, and somewhat discouraging, because we anticipate some public opposition to this project, some stakeholder opposition to going forward with this dry berth project, we anticipate that this federal resource clearance project could add an additional 12 to 18 months to the design and implementation of this project. because of those circumstances, we will be obligated, and don't expect now that we're going to get excluded or excused from having to go through those clearances, those more comprehensive federal clearances. Section 106 review and going through environmental assessments through NEPA, and it becomes a pretty elongated and protracted process. We don't know yet that to be the fact for sure, but the schedule we laid out for you this morning assumes that to be the case, so this is kind of a worst-case scenario in terms of the delivery of this project. So we would start the project design in October and unfortunately not be able to finish the design until December 2010, if that in fact becomes necessary for us to complete these federal resource clearances. Given then, we would not start the construction until the summer of 2011 and be complete and then with the final dry berth of the ship by the summer of 2012. So that's our timeline currently, and we'll certainly keep you posted of how that materializes. I'll ask Chris to stay because he is, well, the project manager for this next project. Commissioners, really happy to report this afternoon that we have begun construction in March of our new conference center at the Kerrville Wildlife Management Area. When completed, this 4,300-square-foot new facility will include a classroom and conference room capable of supporting and accommodating 100 people. Have a lobby, restrooms, a kitchen, and lots of really nice outdoor covered porch areas for wildlife management staff and others to mingle and gather. Noticed Donnie Frell's in the audience. He's been a great customer and client for us. He's been really supportive and helping us with this project. I don't know if he's still with us. Yeah, he's back there. But we're excited about this opportunity. It's about a $1.4 million project to build this 4,300-square-foot facility, largely donor-funded. We expect to complete construction this coming February in 2009. And by the way, our contractor is HRE Incorporated out of Fredericksburg. It was a successful contractor for this project. Certainly, last but not least, I would like to ask Dr. Gary Saul to join me. I wanted to brief you a little bit about our East Texas Fish Hatchery project, a project that we are working on jointly with Inland Fisheries. This is certainly not an infrastructure project. This is as much an Inland Fisheries project, and to them we extend a lot of thanks and support for making this happen, especially Gary. This is an aerial view that Gary provided me of A.E. Wood Fish Hatchery, just to give you a glimpse of what our new hatchery in Jasper might look like. We are really pleased that we are making great progress with this project. As you know, this hatchery is going to be constructed in Jasper County, immediately south of Sam Rayburn Reservoir. The design of this facility was completed in late 2007 and was released for bids this past January. The good news is that last week our project team, made up of Inland Fisheries and Infrastructure Division staff, successfully negotiated with our contractor a $27 million price tag, a $27 million project to construct this hatchery. Our successful contractor is Alco Contractors, Alco Construction, out of Beaumont. And a notice of intent to award our construction contract with this firm is in the mail to them today. So we're happy to share with you firsthand their success, our team's success in getting this done and this project finally underway. We originally received bids from two different contracting firms. Both bids exceeded our available budget, but this team, as a result of our creative value engineering and reducing the number of production ponds and deferring the construction of the maintenance building, was able to develop and settle on a scope that was within our budget. Construction is scheduled to start this June and will be completed in the summer of 2010. This is a big deal. I hope you appreciate that. This is a really, in my view, a really important milestone because we regard this East Texas Fish Hatchery project as one of the most predominant and significant projects, you know, this department is managing right now.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a four-year project to where we are now. We're very, very excited about our ability now to go forward, have a contract signed, and turn the earth. We're wanting very much to bring our legislators to this site prior to our next session to let them know that the stamp money that they provided us is certainly going to go to good use, and we're looking very much forward to get this facility underway.
Commissioner, that complete? Certainly, that does complete my presentation. We'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Question is, it stays open where you're starting in June.
Our hope is to start in June.
Commissioner, I had a question on, we are going to have to tow the battleship.
We believe so. We believe, Commissioner Brown, good question. We believe in probably in any scenario, we're going to have to relocate the ship out of its current slip. We're going to have to tow the ship, hopefully somewhere near in the vicinity of the Houston Ship Channel, park it temporarily. That could be up to about a 12-month period while whatever scenario is being developed, so that then the ship could be returned and moved into whatever kind of dry berth situation is created. It could be enclosed, the water evacuated, and the ship then permanently out.
I think you said they were reasonably sure it would float.
Okay. Floating now.
Well, they're not worth it right now. I mean, I have nightmares about the thing sinking in the ship channel. And what is our liability?
And perhaps I appreciate it. Perhaps I misspoke. They are confident that with precautions, in any scenario, we're going to have pumps on board in the event that a compartment might spring a small leak so we can continue to evacuate the water. But they are confident that the steel plating has enough integrity and enough thickness, that structurally the ship is in good enough shape, that they are convinced and are confirming to us that it is with little risk that we could do that within the vicinity of the Houston Ship Channel. Certainly taking it into open water, the open waterways, is not, a recommended step to take.
I guess what is our liability if something did happen there?
We would hold all liability for that, yes, and we would have to ensure that and be confident that,
Steve, I just want to get a clarification. You keep saying in the vicinity of the Houston Ship Channel. Can we avoid taking the ship into the ship channel proper, or will it have to actually, it'll have to go into the channel at some point? And when we park it for 12 months, will it be?
I mean, it is a channel. I mean, I'm looking over my shoulder to make sure I'm not speaking out of turn, but it will have to go into the ship channel to find some resting space or place. And what I meant by in the vicinity of its current slip there at San Jacinto.
When are you going to tow it? I want to make sure I'm off the
coast. It'll be a ways away.
It'll be done by the time we're off.
Steve, we've rescinded your retirement. August, I want you to know. Don't you dare leave us.
A point of reassurance is that the discussions with Oceanic included the Coast Guard's captain of the port, as well as the Corps of Engineers, TCEQ, many, many regulatory authorities. The only one missing at the meeting was the Pilots Association, and they subsequently reported that their review of our proposals were reasonably satisfactory. Those are the real experts that say, I'm not going to touch that thing. There's no way, or bring it on, and they're favorably pleased too. There is at least one site, Steve, that is further down the bay instead of right into the mouth of the ship channel, but it is a very early discussions about a potential berth there. Our interest is to have the ship viewable wherever we take it. We don't lose revenue. We don't have to button up the ship. We actually can get the public to it and continue visitation while it's away from its home. Very important criteria for whatever site we do tow it to.
Thank you, Chris.
And to allay some of your concerns, you know, we have towed the ship before, so it's not going to be a completely new experience for us. We certainly will have the experts, the engineers, the inspectors. We'll be taking all the precautions that are necessary to ensure that we're prepared for anything that might happen. You know, what our consultants have assured us and have confirmed in writing is that in their professional opinion, the ship is in the condition necessary to sustain, you know, a short tow within, you know, some reasonable distance from its current berth.
Are there any other questions, discussion about any of this? Mr. Chairman, this committee has completed its business.
Okay. We've completed our business and we're adjourned. Okay.